Okay, so we have Professor Gus. You like to be called Gus, don't you?
Yeah.
Gus. Yes. Gus Dalgleish. Gus, I just want to say I think you're incredibly brave for coming on to speak to me, because quite a few people think I gave you a hard time a couple of weeks ago, and I can see why they would say that. And it was basically, I was challenging you, I was pushing you regarding the point that at one time you were advocating the mRNA jabs, and especially for younger people who are hesitant. And now you've been quite vocal about the mRNA jabs and their harms. Can I ask you, first of all, can you just describe what it is you do and your journey from the beginning, you know, in January, February, March 2020? Let's go back in time. So who are you? What do you do? And please tell me about your journey. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm Professor of Medical Oncology, and I work for the university, and that my main interest has been in doing clinical research of clinical immunology, initially for melanoma, and then we've broadened it out to other solid tumours. In my past research life, I did a special thesis at the Institute of Cancer Research with Professor Robin Weiss, who was the world expert in retroviruses. And I had become very interested in how these viruses could cause cancer, and also posited their possibility that if they could cause cancer, could they be used to help treat cancer? And that was the kind of what I went in with. And while I was there, HIV/AIDS became a major issue. And because it was a retrovirus, we switched very quickly to from cancer to HIV, as it were. And so I did very detailed research in HIV, and I was lucky enough to be in the right place to discover the receptor, and that sort of kind of made me in that area. And we had several papers in Nature Science and Cell defining all the characteristics of receptor and how HIV killed, etc. And because of all this work, I became very aware of the need for a vaccine for HIV should be very particular and not involve the whole envelope. The whole envelope of HIV was chosen by the NIH, Fauci, Gates, Big Pharma. And this has led to nearly 40 years of total failure to produce a vaccine that works. And we predicted this years ago. And I worked with Norwegian colleagues, Berger Sorensen, and we designed an HIV vaccine. Well, he designed it initially, and I've been involved in improving it, which is based not on the whole envelope, but just on 4 or 5 core epitopes. That actually really works well. It has been shown in a randomized studies to be very effective, even in people who are HIV chronically infected. It will reduce the viral load for months and months, and we've tweaked it. So the point of this story is that when COVID came along, he called me up and we had an interchange saying we should be looking at a COVID vaccine.
Who was he?
Along exactly the Berger Sorensen, from my Norwegian colleague, and I said we'd worked on the HIV vaccine, and we'd had big grants from the Norwegian Research Council, and we'd published, and it was going very well. But when COVID came along, he said, I've just gone through the sequences of this virus, and he said, I think we should apply the same principles that we applied to HIV, and that is not use the whole envelope, or spike as it was called, the spike protein for COVID. He said, first of all, he said there is an 80% homology with human epitopes, so side effects are fairly guaranteed. And secondly, what we became notorious for, as opposed to famous, was he said there are 6 inserts in this virus, and one of them's a furin cleavage site, which has been omitted and ignored. and that these inserts give the virus the highest charge of any coronavirus ever, suggesting that it cannot be natural. And we tried to publicize this. We took it to contacts who were able to give it to people in the cabinet and to the scientists, Witte and people.
When was this?
And they all, this was exactly January, February 2020.
So this is now challenging the narrative. Sorry, so this is challenging the narrative that it came out of a wet lab and it's natural and it's just an evolutionary thing.
Oh, yeah, I mean, right. From day one, we say it's impossible. And the reason I was able to take an issue on this is because having worked in HIV and worked with people who got it wrong for so long and seen that Berger's concept was the only one that was right. So I trusted the way he takes it is that the people who said, oh, it's all natural, they're people who just look at sequences, molecular sequences. But sequences mean nothing in biology unless they're translated to amino acids. And once you translate to amino acids, you have to formulate those into protein. And there are a different set of laws which all the molecular biologists I know don't seem to be aware of. And these are laws of biophysics and charge. And with Berger, who is a biophysicist, first and foremost, basically said these break all the laws. They cannot occur. They'd have been edited out. So they've been inserted. And then we found that they had been inserted and in the Wuhan lab, and they had actually published. Aren't we clever? We've done these changes to the these bat viruses, and they can now infect human cells, and they can infect human ACE2 receptor.
When did the Wuhan lab publish that they'd done this?
Well, it came out in January 2020. Oh, when they'd previously published as far back as 2013, 2015, 17. Oh, no, it'd been out there in the literature a long time. And this is what we couldn't understand. Even we referenced all this, nobody would listen to us. Nobody would publish it. We did it in fine detail. And Nature, Science, Journal of Virology, Lancet, they all turned it down, our paper on this, within 5 hours, saying it wasn't in the public interest. It was
at
this point
unusual?
I realized that there was a...
Do you think that's unusual, that
very,
no
very
one was
unusual.
Interested? Why in your scientific...
It was like there was...
Sorry, I was saying in your scientific...
It was like there was a conspiracy...
Sorry, there's a background delay, I think. So I was saying, in your history of doing scientific research, I mean, this must have been quite strange and unusual to you. Why do you think no one was interested? Because this is kind of groundbreaking. It's of course, newsworthy and scientific worthy.
Well, it was very newsworthy scientifically, and it should have been debated. The points we raised should have been debated and either quashed or agreed that we are partially right, partially wrong. It should not have been completely crushed, not suitable in the public interest for further discussion. Even when we actually alerted people outside of the scientific community about this, nobody was interested. They told us to be quiet. I was told I was only an oncologist. What did I know about virology? Which actually told me a lot about the people who said that, because I've actually published probably more in virology than certainly clinical trials.
Sorry,
so
who were the people telling? Who were the people telling you to be quiet?
Well, within the scientific community, my peers and colleagues, it was like they all said, you know, what do you know? Be quiet. It was like somebody had set the narrative and everybody had signed up to it. The closest I got to it was an esteemed colleague in America who basically said along the lines, I don't disagree with you, but there's nothing to be gained with upsetting the Chinese. Now, that seemed to me to be a ridiculous narrative, which I said, but it is at the death of science. I said, once you won't discuss these issues and go through the data, and also if there's a disagreement, you should actually set out your stall, do some experiments to prove or disprove, null hypothesis, as it were. Nobody was interested in doing any of these things. Matt Ridley, with whom I've had discussions with at meetings, I mean, he set out to show that the virus was natural. And in no time at all, he'd come to the conclusion that it was far more likely to escape from the laboratory, but he couldn't prove it. And the staggering thing that he told me was that he tried to discuss it logically with people, fellows of the Royal Society. It's meant to be the bastion of British science. And he was told by them that they hadn't looked at everything in detail because it wasn't necessary. It was so obviously a zoonotic jump like SARS-1. So here you have people at the top of science can't even be bothered officially to look at the data and wouldn't go along with him with anything other than it was natural. We now know from all the big research it was not natural.
This is crazy. So who is what Matt we're Ridley, dealing, by the way? Who was Matt Ridley?
Matt Ridley wrote the... Well, he's Lord Matt Ridley. He's been a lord for a long time. He's a specialist scientific journalist, and he wrote the book Viral, on the origins of the virus with Alicia Shan. And it's even been used and quoted in the parliamentary issues on this, where they seem to have... gone from saying it's definitely a natural zoonosis to the questions open. So that's the way they've dealt with it.
Can I ask you something? Is there an HIV subunit in this virus?
Yes, there's small sequence in the virus, but it's not sinister. It is. It tells you that it came from the lab because the sequences of HIV that are in the virus were picked up when they were passaging or polishing the virus, as we call it, to train it to like to infect human cell receptor. They put the human cell receptor, for ACE2 receptor, which these viruses like binding to, they put it into another cell using a lentiviral vector, which happened to be HIV. And it's been pointed out that this vector is exactly the same little HIV sequences in it as in the COVID virus. So that's where it was picked up. It was picked up from passaging. It's not an unusual thing to do, but it proves it came from the laboratory because you don't pick up HIV sequences from natural jumping about animals.
No. Why do you think people were manipulating and playing with these viruses? I really struggle with the whole idea of gain of function. It's almost as if you're creating a Frankenstein's monster. Is it bioweaponry? I mean, what is the ultimate desire of scientists to do this?
Well, there is no doubt that there has been a big drive from bioweaponry to establish things which are infectious, which would disarm your opponent, etc. I mean, that's not scientific. What's the word I'm looking for? I mean, it's not outside the realm of normal development. But what is, I think, was outside of the normal relevant, unless there's something going on in the bioweapons program we don't know about, is why they were trying to make it more infectious so they could design better vaccines. Well, why would you want to make something clearly dangerous so you can provide better vaccine? If you didn't make it clearly dangerous, you wouldn't need the vaccine. So there was a very, I was going to say, I don't know the correct word for this, but there was something very mysterious as to why this gain of function work, which was being pushed by Tony Fauci, there was no doubt about that. Obama's administration told them to stop unless it was absolutely necessary. We now know Tony Fauci funded all this work in the Wuhan labs and first became suspicious because he denied it, but that usually means nothing these days, unfortunately. He did it by covert funding through the EcoHealth Alliance by a chap called Peter Daszak, who was the first to organise 26/7 scientists to write to The Lancet saying, any idea this came from the lab is pure conspiracy and must be squashed, and we just must look at the science. This was ironic because he was just trying to protect his own back, as was Fauci. So they have lied about this. We now know that this work was would not have been possible without the funding from Fauci through the EcoHealth Alliance, because it funded the work of Ralph Barrick in Chapel Hill, Carolina, who was the first scientist to be able to sew RNA together so you couldn't find the join, to make it so it left no imprint. I was told that, as if I was stupid, that if this had happened, they would have left an imprint and it would be obvious to everybody. They seem to be irrelevant. This is why Ralph Barrick is very famous, while he's a big Academy member in America, because he perfected this technique. And the Wuhan lab were using his technique to do all these gain of functions in bat cells. So what is the big deal? And interestingly, the papers they've published, there's no real subversion here, because Ralph Barrick's name is on all these papers, as is funding from the EcoHealth Alliance. And in at least one of the papers, it's been pointed out to me, it even gives credit to the fact the funding originally came from Tony Fauci. So, I mean, none of this is conspiracy theory. I mean, this is just tracing the threads, the facts.
Have you seen, there's a lot of documents circulating that's saying that a lot of the funding actually came from DOD, Defense, Department of Defense in America, and DARPA. And even the vaccine, the mRNA jab, actually was funded by DOD, DARPA, and Moderna and Pfizer BioNTech simply produced what was being researched by them. Have you come across any of this?
Yes, I have. I have not the core data, all the reports linking that. The reports of the patents for the virus, COVID virus vaccine, going back to long before it escaped, as it were, which is very, very concerning to me indeed. The this is a new layer on the story. The story that I had picked up on with everybody else I've been talking to, researching, etc., is, yes, it was being funded out of America, which is why they were so keen to keep quiet and shut people like me up, because it all went back to Tony Fauci, who Ralph Paul, one of the big senators, you know, has accused him of lying, absolute lying, and he's really got very upset that he didn't. And then they start arguing semantics about gain of function. So, you know, he was involved with that. We know he was involved with Daszak, and we know that Daszak was very, very close to Batwoman, as they call her, and very, very friendly at conferences
who's
and things,
the
and funded. Funded her work.
Who's Bat
Li Sheng? Ling Shi. She's the woman who's on all the papers that come out of the Wuhan lab on gain of function, and who was involved with the virus being sequenced early on.
Can I ask something that really I struggle with? And I am a dumb orthopod after all, so don't hold that against me. But basically, if the spike protein is the dangerous part of this virus, why would you create a therapy that produces more of that said dangerous part in your body? Why would you put something that's a dangerous part in your body to replicate it again and again? Surely couldn't they make a vaccine where an inert, you know, part of the virus was actually being replicated? Why the spike protein? I don't understand that.
Well, that's what Berger and I pushed for right from the beginning. We're able to get our argument through to the cabinet office level and all the advisors and the medical advisors, who all chose to ignore us.
So,
warnings were completely correct.
Am I right in saying that it's a ridiculous notion to produce the part of the virus that's actually the lethal part?
I would say you're absolutely right. But my problem and your problem and everyone's problem is that 150 different companies, universities and biotechs all decided, with the exception of myself and Berger, that it was the correct thing to do. So it's very bad. It's very hard to hold back a tsunami if you've only got a hand on a beach, as it were.
But why? Why this mass conformity? Because science should be about debate, challenging, questioning what has led us to this point where everyone was singing from the same hymn sheet.
I totally agree. It was dystopian and Orwellian, whereas any alternative was not only ridiculed and cancelled, but, you know, absolutely denied. I mean, normally in a scientific debate, like the Manhattan Project, for instance, you'd call all the top people together and bash it all out until you'd all got something you agreed on. There was nothing approaching that with this. It was like it was all predetermined, and anybody who disagreed was a troublemaker. And more recently, of course, dealing with fake news, as it were. I mean, spreading misinformation. That is the staggering thing. Anybody who tried to be rational on this was immediately spreading misinformation, cancelled by the mainstream media, and then we've got Twitter and all these people cancelled everything as well. We now know that they were being paid billions, these agencies. Social media, mainstream media, was being ordered by government. I did an interview with a mainstream channel who's moved a bit to the centre, who told me straight to my face that the government have made it an offence to criticise the vaccine programme, so they have to be very obtuse in how they discuss it. I said, I cannot believe that. They said, yes, they made it a total offence to do so, and we're not allowed to do it. With the Twitter and all those, we now know that the government paid these people to get rid of any anti-COVID narrative, whether it be, why don't we treat it with this, because they're logical and simple and cheap. There's problems with the vaccine. There's some side effects with the vaccine. They were paid to delete all that stuff. It is beyond belief, but they did. And we now know that Pfizer paid a fortune to numerous groups to lobby for the vaccine, and even worse, to lobby for vaccine mandates. They actually paid for all this to be done. So this is something which we've never, ever experienced before. If this was a virus which we had right to be fear, such as the Spanish flu or Ebola, that killed 50% of people who got infected, and the average age a person was dying was between 20 and 40 or so, a very young population, you might just conceive that some of this was justified. But for a virus that killed people at an average age older than everybody else dying from anything else, it was madness.
That's actually correct. The Freedom of Information data came out showing that the people who died of nothing but COVID, the average life expectancy was something like 81, which is 2 years older than everyone else who died. So, I mean, the Princess Diamond cruise ship data.
No, for Britain. Yeah. Well, yes. The data I saw for the UK was average age of death for COVID was 82. Average age of death from everything else is 81. And it is very interesting that before COVID, the average age of death was about 84. So the whole non-COVID deaths has been age of death has been falling, not only here but in the US. They've also been falling at a similar rate. So we seem to have peaked from the ever increasing age, as it were. But COVID was not the problem.
So Angus, at one point you said to me off air that right early on you're attending meetings, cabinet levels, and you're being shut down. Can you tell me what was going on and when was this?
Well, I mean, I wasn't attending any cabinet meetings, but we had a contact who was phoning and asking for various bits of information. So we sent information and we sent our concerns through, and we do know they were discussed, because I had my concerns about how it should be handled. You know, I got replies from Chris Whitty's number two person saying they looked at it interesting, but not there's not enough data. I mean, they even told me that when I said, look, we don't have anything at the moment, but what we do know is a respiratory airborne virus, which we don't have a particular treatment for. The one thing we do know is the most single important thing you can do is to correct vitamin D, because it will correlate dramatically. We know that from all the work we have done. And Chris Whitty came back and informed me there wasn't enough data on it. I mean, at that time, we had 1,000 publications showing the importance of vitamin D. We forwarded about 100, was told that was far too many. And they still try to argue, well, there were problems with the data. There was no problem with vitamin D data. For COVID, when it did come out, when we first had really good data, there's now 4 massive papers showing the importance of vitamin D. Had they listened to this, they would have saved us from everything, the lockdown, the masks and all this rubbish, and the vaccine program. They have saved us all if they had done this vitamin D, because the big Spanish study showed very, very clear. They did the sort of study that was the most useful, instead of doing prospective studies and what have you. When they had the carnage, they looked at what correlated. So when they looked at everybody hospitalized positive COVID in the Spanish hospitals, and they monitored those that went to ITU, those that died, and then did meta-analysis. You do not need to be a statistician to know that the fact, if your vitamin D level was below 30 and you went into hospital, you had a 77% chance of death. If your vitamin D level was over 75, a nice healthy level, your chance of death was 2%. There is no treatment, no vaccine can come anywhere close to that. And my argument was just give everybody free vitamin D. And when they came up with the, as it was trendy to call it then, the BAME issue, they did a BAME report on COVID, and they went on about deprivation and all sorts of garbage like that. They didn't even mention vitamin D. And, you know, I had reported that as a clinician, I check all my, for the last 20 odd years, I have checked everybody's vitamin D. I have never seen a black skinned or a heavily darkened Asian skin with a vitamin D over 30 unless they take supplements. And here you're asking why this group was in the excess. It was nearly completely related to vitamin D. Obviously, there are other issues, the obesity, diabetes, which actually also correlated with the vitamin D totally independently. And the only other thing, which again, they didn't really get, and I know this from a colleague who died, he was the only colleague who died of COVID who was actually on the front line. He had a severe sickle cell trait. And we know that all those thalassemias, sickle cell traits, this, that, and the, they all interfered with oxygenation if you got things. So those were the two big known things, and they were kind of all ignored. Anything that tried to treat people before they went into hospital was ignored. And we know we have this case of this GP, Sam White, who got reported to the GMC for trying to do the best of his patients and get them to do logical things to reduce the chances of the thing spreading, all of which were completely logical. Why would you do that? Well, I'm afraid that people who have looked into this big time have basically said the only explanation for this is if there was had identified anything that was slightly useful in controlling and treating the disease, you could not possibly justify a vaccine program. And it's interesting, in spite of the fact that I'm very annoyed with the lack of response of Chris Whitty and his, what I recall, nonsensical replies to issues that we've raised, is that it is recorded in notes that he said, why would we need a vaccine when the death rate is actually now so low? So why didn't he do something about it?
These are very, very good questions. I just want to clarify for some of the listeners, vitamin D is actually a hormone. It's not a vitamin. It's been mislabeled. Vitamin D is required for normal physiological bodily function. Every cell in the body has a vitamin D receptor. And vitamin D is crucial for immune health as well as preventing cancer. So it's a very, very important hormone. Now, being someone who's got slightly darker skin color, you're absolutely right. If I don't take supplements, I am vitamin D deficient. There's a lot of background noise. Is that your end or my end, by the way?
I'm afraid it's my end because we have a helicopter pad nearby for emergencies.
Okay.
It'll get.
So the vitamin D is a big issue, and I take supplements. And I would argue if you're ever going to mandate anything, and I do not believe in mandates, and I don't care what the fatality rate is, you should never mandate anything. It goes against medical ethics. But if you were ever going to mandate anything, then it should have been vitamin D, which is safe and effective. So the question is, why was early treatment suppressed? Why were measures that would definitely have helped people not been introduced by our chief medical officer and chief scientific officer? This is past gross negligence. This is almost criminal. But didn't you argue that?
Well, I would argue that, not to say we don't know what's going on, but we treat everything as an airborne respiratory virus, and we do what we've always done for colds and flus, etc. And that is the vitamin D, first and foremost, first, second, third. Second, soluble aspirin. Gargle with it. It's very good anti-inflammatory for the back of the throat to stop it spreading. Ipsy facto, you also then do mouthwash. Mouthwash is very good at disinfecting. And I recommend that people did this 2 to 3 hourly, both, if they got the symptoms. And that there's a thing called first defense. You can squirt it up your nose. I use that. It used to have interferon in it. Now it has an acid lipid they claim is just as good. I actually suggest that to the government, the chief medical officers. They didn't follow it up. And the other thing is the antihistamines. And if it's going to go down your throat, Becotide. And that was the other one of the great big scandals. We know that if something starts to go down the throat, it's the inflammation drives everything. So you want to damp it down with Becotide. Now, I had 2 or 3 very good friends who called me because they were so ill, whether they should go into hospital because they were really short of breath. But they were reluctant. And they'd only just come on, like overnight, these symptoms. And they knew they'd been in contact with COVID people. I got them to do that. And they were better within 24 hours, 48 hours, completely better. None of them proceeded to hospital. So why were doctors not pushing that? It was beyond belief. And it gets even worse, because when you did get into hospital, they had this, and I said at the time, when I realized what it was, stupid recovery program. It was randomized. Everything has to be randomized. Even common sense out the window has to be randomized. It's unbelievable. They had dexamethasone as one of the treatments. When anybody with half an hour of intensive care and doing respiratory medicine will know that when you've got people short of breath like that from a viral infection, you put them on dexamethasone. Surprise, surprise. It was the only thing that came out of the trial that worked. And one of my colleagues calculated up to over 4,000 people died because they went on that program and were denied dexamethasone. And he thinks that's an underestimate. So this is the level of incompetence that we were dealing with in handling this so-called pandemic.
Gus, can I just say something? I really respect what you're doing. You're putting your neck out on the line. You're speaking against the grain. Mm. There's very few people, especially of your seniority, who are talking against the narrative and speaking up. Can you please, however, once more talk through why it is you wrote that Daily Mail article telling young people to take the vaccine, even if they had taken had COVID before, reassuring them that it won't affect them and their fertility and their immune system? It was quite a coercive
piece. It was coercive, and I was coerced. I didn't write that article. I was interviewed on the telephone by the Daily Mail to do that. I had done a couple of articles before, whereas previously I would discuss things through with a ghostwriter, and we would agree it. That piece was coerced, and it was just discussions over it, and it appeared how it was. I had no chance to go over it. I was very uncomfortable with it because of the coercive nature of it. We now know this was government forcing mainstream media into doing what they did. At the time that that was written, I remember they were worried about it spreading and whether it made sense to vaccinate people who were doing all the face-to-face interactions, people on the front line like nurses, doctors, policemen, people delivering, etc. And I did say at that time, well, that makes more sense than vaccinating everyone, just the ones who are most likely to spread it. But at that time, I was being force-fed that the vaccine was working, that there were no side effects, and this is was the way to go. And as I mentioned, I was uncomfortable, but I thought there's no point just being a rebel for the sake of it. But it was when my son had to have it for a job and got myocarditis, I suddenly realised, and started talking and phoning around and talking to everybody else, I suddenly realised it was a disaster. Now, I have tried my very hardest, and I've written articles, all sorts of things, about the dangers of the vaccine, particularly for young people and children. I've even got them all the way through various editorial stages. They never, ever appear. They are canned by the editor at the top. And that's not just the Mail, that's other mainstream media as well. So it is, they are being ruled. So we have an Orwellian state here. We don't have a free press anymore. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that we do. And even the so-called social media is no longer, it's being suppressed and censored to death. I never thought we'd see this.
I want to come back. I know I never thought I'd see this. I want to come back to the media censorship. I want to go back to the Daily Mail. When on the Twitter space, you actually used the word bullied, which I thought was incredible. You said that they were
bullied. I used the word what?
Bullied. You were being bullied, and that it was a bullying article. You're basically, you know,
Well, it was, yes, because I wasn't, it wasn't one that I wanted to write under my own thing. They wrote it first and basically used me as the bully boy to go along and give it some kind of credence. But at the time, as I said, I had actually come to the argument, if you're going to vaccinate people, to stop it spreading. That was because we were actually going along with what we now know to be a big pack of lies, that the vaccine could prevent you spreading it infectious. We now know that's total, utter rubbish. So everything changed. So when everything changed, when facts change, I changed too, very much. But at the time, I was unhappy with that article, very unhappy. But I was not able subsequently to put the record straight in it. I mean, they just won't touch anything that criticises the vaccine. And as you know, I've been a main signatory to the Children's Committee Against Vaccines and everything with Ross Jones and Claire Craig. I have presented petitions. I've signed lots of letters. We've got lots of data together for this, that, and the other. And it is, again, incredible, the total lack of interest of mainstream media. The only people who have taken any notice of us whatsoever in the media has actually been the GB News. And the first person to pick up on this, who is Mark Stein, has silenced. And as you know, Neil Oliver has also picked up on it, and they're trying to silence him. This is not a society or a state that I ever want to continue living in if the way it's carrying on. We must have free and open debate, and there isn't such. As I mentioned, I went to, even there's a political forum where they have various debates, and I went to one of these meetings. I wrote about it in the Daily Skeptic. I thought I was going to it, but I was informed that it was full. And that, but I could watch it online. And when I watched it online, as I pointed out, the first thing I was a noticed was the empty seats. And then was the fact that the only people allowed to ask questions were those who praised how wonderful the speakers were and how great the vaccine program. And that there was not a single question on, I mean, to me, the big thing, and this is where I hold everybody to account, I mean, everybody, Department of Health, NHS, the government, Chris Whitty, MHRA, even the GMC, because they've been going along persecuting people for this. When they had the swine flu, a big problem in the United States in 1976, they basically pushed for this to be vaccinated to do something about it. The reason for it, they had soldiers dying in their mid-20s, going down an infection that was killing them. So they thought this is a real emergency. They got the vaccine rolled out and made by about four different manufacturers. And they had treated about 45 million people with the vaccine when there was this constant background that Guillain-Barre was rising from a very low level. Now, the FDA sent people out to interview these doctors. They actually looked at the data. And when it went up from about 1 point something in 100,000, then it went to 3, 5, 7. And in one place, it went to about 9 per 100,000. So, yeah, this is relatively, yeah, but it's a serious problem because they were paralyzed, etc. They turned round and they said, ah, the flu is no longer dangerous. It's not killing anybody and it's virtually gone away, and stop the vaccine program. I think we reached that 18 months ago, even if you're going to be generous that the vaccine might have been useful in some people at the beginning. That is the big issue. Why did nobody do that? That's why we've the big Persis documents gone in about the MHRA. I mean, there was also in researching that someone uncovered the fact that MHRA seemed to think that the Department of Health was monitoring in the other way around, which meant they admitted there's nobody monitoring this thing seriously.
Well, what it shows to
people
me,
have, you know, why?
What it shows to me is everyone's now pointing fingers at someone else. No one's taking responsibility. And
quite
and,
right.
I mean, if we look at typical vaccine development, it's 10 to 15 years. This was not 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. There's hundreds of people have reached out to me, lay people. They said, look, we're working class, we're uneducated. Even we could see that this was experimental. It's a new type of vaccine. It's mRNA technology, never been tested before. Why do you think so many doctors, including yourself, fell for it? Because lay people don't understand it. They're like, we could see this was nonsense. Why did the doctors go along with it? Why were alarm bells not ringing in your head thinking, I work with vaccine development. This has taken decades to develop. Did you not think, what the hell is going on?
Well, indeed, but there appeared to be a mentality that they were expecting this and going to push the button and do the vaccine and everything would be fine. We saw with AstraZeneca, they did it in their own way, and because they rolled it out quickest and it was not messenger RNA, they ran into problems with clots and things which they didn't want to admit initially, what have you. But when it became an issue, it was quietly withdrawn. It became an issue, I think, because of Pfizer and Moderna. It was very convenient for them to be able to blame a vaccine that was not as good as theirs in their eyes, as it were. So I think that was all part and parcel of what seemed to be a grand plan, was to encourage a pandemic. Let's be generous, because it certainly wasn't natural. And to have a plan of vaccination and everything to control it.
What I want to know is, do you feel that you were duped? And are you sorry for any mistakes you've made? And would you encourage other doctors to just speak out now and say, it's okay to say, I've got it wrong. This is, we can't go on like this. We need to stop.
Of course. I mean, look, I know very few, well, people who weren't duped and stood up were basically bullied, harassed, reported the GMC or put in gardening leave or whatever. Those of us who thought that, well, if everybody else thinks this is a good idea, we'd sort of go along with it. But then when you see that people are in a state of kind of mass psychosis and won't actually have any objective assessment of what's going on, then I think you have to have a duty to speak out. It's like me. I've been admonished for pointing out that I think that some of my patients have relapsed because the only thing I can identify is with the COVID booster. And I'm used to patients relapsing in the melanoma world that I do, but they nearly always have a very good reason for relapsing. They have a period of excess stress, upset, where they go into an immune suppression depression. And I couldn't identify that in any of my patients. And the only thing I could identify was that these things had all started after the booster. Not the first and the second, but the booster. Now, I had worked on vaccines for a long, long time, in cancer vaccines, and I remember that we have, with cancer vaccines, you like to be able to boost a bit. They're not like, they're more therapeutic vaccines as opposed to preventative, obviously. You don't get, the only preventative vaccines are those that go against a virus that might cause it, like hepatitis B. So it's not unusual to look at giving a booster because the cancer keeps suppressing all the time. But we came across a model that one vaccine good, two vaccines slightly better, third vaccine makes things, you might as well not have given the first and second dose, but more importantly, the fourth vaccine actually encourages the disease you were trying to damp down and prevent. That model came to me when I started seeing this, particularly when I started to see the reports that the booster is associated with class switching. No longer IgG1 and 3 goes to 4. So it goes from attempts to make neutralizing antibodies, which I pointed out right from the beginning, is complete waste of time, because the booster is boosting against the virus which left the planet a year ago. And contrary to all the lies and rubbish that's been put forward, that if you make antibodies, they're not going to cross-react and be cross-species protective. They actually cause immunological, the first vaccine causes immunological imprinting or antigenic sin. So goading the immune system will just see the first. It will not spread to the second, and you get antibody.
Is that antibody-dependent enhancement?
And that then includes that. It's not the original drive, but then you're inducing these antibodies and they end up enhancing and you get antibody-dependent enhancement. So the whole thing is a waste of time. And then I read articles of immune suppression after the booster. Well, this to me is actually, again, quite logical that you would get an immune suppression after, because you've got a fixed resource in your immune response, and by a booster, you're using a lot of primed immune response. About half your immune response is fighting something that's no longer there. And therefore, everything else is being suppressed. So your T-cell function is depressed until it recovers, and which is why people who had their boosters, they were all going down with COVID or other virological infections. And then I'm seeing the relapse. So I was told there's no evidence for this. Shut up. Even by my own colleagues, because they said their patients were telling them that I was saying this, and they didn't want to have the COVID booster. And their natural reaction, it was this group thing. Oh, he's just a maverick wildcard. Don't listen to him. You must have it. It's what the government's decided. That answers your question about doctors. They're just doing what the government decides. Free-thinking, creative doctors have been basically banned under the way the NHS operates, and actually the private sector's taking it up, with real enthusiasm too. You're only allowed to do what's in a certain.
I'll be honest with you. I am very disappointed with doctors. I have obviously very upset with our politicians, the media, big tech, big pharma, Bill Gates, the WHO. I'm a doctor. I'm a doctor, and I can talk about my colleagues and my profession. And I've never felt so let down. There's 280,000 doctors in this country, and there's literally, you could count them on two hands, the number of doctors who are speaking out. And either people believe the government narrative, in which case it's unquestioning obedience and they've been brainwashed and there's no critical thinking, or they're quiet and they're just preserving themselves and their career and their job and their reputation. But I think patient safety is patient safety, and medical ethics is medical ethics. And we are meant to be the defenders and advocates for these. And if we're not going to speak out, this is why trust in our profession is, I believe, you know, destroyed. You know, most people no longer trust doctors, don't feel safe going to hospitals. And I think that's a tragedy. I'm absolutely gutted. And the fact that doctors are now, in my opinion, gaslighting patients and telling them that their symptoms are not vaccine harm is even worse. I'll give you an example. There's a colleague, I agree totally on that.
Yeah.
There's a doctor in the private hospital who's a neurologist. And he was in the clinic room before I started my clinic. So he was wrapping up. I went into the room, and there's a little chat in between. I said, "How are things?" He said, "Very busy." I said, what do you think's driving everything then?" "Vaccines." Hushed tones. It was just the two of us in the room. I said, "Really? You think so?" He went, "Absolutely. Weird and wonderful neurology. It's crazy." I said, "What are you doing about it?" "I'm telling everyone not to have any more shots." I went, "Anything more than that?" "No." "Are you reporting it?" "No." "Are you speaking out about it?" "No, definitely not." And he walked out the room. Now, I find that incredulous. How did we get here, Gus?
I know. It's the same. I mean, I've been going on about the melanoma. Then I started to find that people I knew in my social circle were being diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or early leukemias. And I thought, well, if you do lose control of your T-cell, you perturbate your T-cell control, your melanomas will be one of the first to go, because that is how we do put them into control, immunotherapy, one way or the other. But your next lot to go will be the B-cell ones, because especially with a vaccine that depresses the T-cell, it's also stimulating specifically B-cells. So if you stimulate B-cells to make lots of antibodies that are not necessary, some of them are going to go to the next stage and start to become a low-grade malignancy and then malignant. And that's what we're seeing. And just to reflect what your observation there, I went to another place, and I saw somebody I hadn't seen for a while, and I said, "Oh, I haven't seen you for ages. How are you?" She said, "Well, I'm not too bad, but I've been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma." She says, "I've got these various lumps around the neck, this, that, and the other." And I said something which, again, things you say and do, and I think I said something quite inane, but just kind of social polite. And I go, "My God, I wonder what on earth caused that." I mean, completely stupid for a clinician, an oncologist, to say something. So that's just social banter, saying, "You know, this is terrible. You know, I wonder what caused that." I could have been pushed over backwards by her reply. She said, "Oh, it's the vaccine." I said, "Who told you that?" She said, "My oncologist." She said, "They are seeing loads of lymphomas following the vaccine." Same thing. Have I heard word from them?
No one's speaking out.
No one's speaking out.
I think it's absolutely incredulous. Now, I don't know about you, but this has shaken and torn apart my faith in every institution and everything that I looked up to. And it terrifies me at the same time. And I think it's basically, it shows me that the Western civilization is collapsing. When you cannot trust our politicians, when you cannot trust the regulatory bodies, when you cannot trust doctors, the whole idea of scientific debate, openness, transparency, democracy, accountability, responsibility, justice, it's gone. And it's dark days, as far as I'm concerned, where good people who speak out are being punished for simply asking questions. Now, I don't know. I am also very hesitant now about the whole idea of vaccines. I think it's a sacred cow. The problem is that it's been an issue that people have now ingrained within us that vaccines are amazing. You cannot question vaccines. I've looked into vaccine science now and vaccine development, and the studies are very flawed, especially childhood vaccines. They compare the new vaccine against an old vaccine. There's never a control group. There's never a comparison, a placebo, true placebo group. I mean, now with all of this stuff coming to light, are you questioning anything?
Of course. I mean, one of the things that I am questioning, and I mean, the person who raises this to the fore was this mantra, especially oncologists have been there. Nothing can be done unless there's a double-blind, randomized controlled trial. That has been our mantra. That's the way we've worked in oncology, have you? And of course, the person who spouts this is Tony Fauci. Now, we now know that with the vaccine trials, this double-blind proven, it wasn't double-blind at all because they unblinded those trials so quickly so the people in the control arm could have the benefit of the vaccine. No, they did it to confuse the side effect issue so you couldn't blame the vaccine very quickly. He wouldn't have good treatments, which were people, lots of doctors knew that the various things I was talking about with extras like N-acetylcysteine, high-dose vitamin C, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, etc. Anything like that, he basically said they were dangerous, God knows what else, and he'd only accept them in a double-blind trial. Of course, was there a funding for a double-blind trial and all those things? No, everything that was done to prevent them. And when they did do a one for ivermectin, it was designed so it had no hope of working whatsoever because it was only given to people far too late who were going to die. So he wouldn't have it because of the double-blind trial. So he used double-blind trials as semantics, not as objective scientific rationale. And I suddenly started to look back at our oncology studies and realize that I believe that we've been totally misled and run by Big Pharma all the way through. As an oncology drug, one of the greatest successes, certainly commercially, and has a good scientific justification where I can actually show you why it was fundamentally flawed, was Avastin. Which Avastin was the big oncology drug. Remember, they politically got it approved earlier for breast cancer. It was used for colorectal, everything, you name it, sold billions and billions and billions. Now we know that it has very little efficacy at all. So the pharmaceutical company's done very, very well out of it. And the same way we pointed the obvious problems with making a vaccine for COVID and HIV out, right, very, very early on, was just totally ignored. But it was there, the kernel of its own destruction was there, is that when you use Avastin systems, it blocks one of seven vascular pathways. So you block one, within 6 months, the system's using the others. So it was never going to last for more than 6 months because it didn't go for plan B, plan C, how to deal with that knock-on effect. Well, I'm starting to seriously question a lot of the so-called randomized studies because they're fundamentally flawed. I don't know if you saw that the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine for 20 years, I'm terribly sorry, I can't remember her name, but she basically said she left actually in the end in disgust that over half the big trials that they published were actually fraudulent. And I've heard the same thing for so-called pure scientific papers, Nature and Science. It is not uncommon to hear people say only half of them can be reproduced or only half of them are stand the test of time, which is terrible indictment when these same papers just refuse to even look at the data as not in the public interest. When we point out the evidence that this escaped from the lab is screaming, it does have very major implications. It has major implications for how you design the vaccine and how you control it. And of course, if we're going to go into what it means for the future, and I was really quite amazed to be asked to go on Nigel Farage's show to discuss this very point. is, what is the future if our government wants to sign up future control of all pandemics to the WHO? An organisation that's so inherently corrupt and incompetent, if it had been remotely competent, the virus would never have left China. Whether it jumped from a bat or a raccoon or escaped from a lab, if they had done their job, it would never have left China. So we want, basically, to hand over all our control to an unelected, incompetent organisation. And I thought that it was very, very bright and pertinent to pick up. That is the big Achilles heel of this whole thing, is that we're making it more likely to have pandemics, because they seem to be hopeless at spotting them and controlling them, but they seem to be love the idea of getting everyone to be locked down and to have all these restrictions placed on them, and everybody have a compulsory jab and keep doing it. We know it doesn't work, but it's all we can do at the moment. That seems to be the mantra.
Well,
that's the most frightening.
It seems like, should I let you, is that your phone?
1 minute. Sorry.
I was saying, it seems like pandemics are great business. And, you know, I think Bill Gates and someone else, maybe the Pfizer CEO, talked about future pandemics. So this thing that, you know, we see once every 100 years, that's a big thing, now seems to be something that we should expect quite frequently. And they're almost plandemics. It seems like these pandemics are manufactured, especially if we look at the patents and everything that we're looking at in terms of the mRNA jabs. What I'm looking at is, we had a period of enlightenment in the West that led and flourished industry, creativity, scientific progress, the scientific method, and that's lost. And now I think we're entering the dark ages, where we have a very corrupt system, very flawed, and the rot is deep. We do not have a scientific method, and we have corrupt institutions and colleges, and I don't see how we get out of this. That's my personal take. And I'm very concerned, not just about myself, but to be honest, my future, children, what is their lives going to be like moving forward? Because I was very proud to be born in this country, a free, democratic country, a scientific, liberal. And it's unrecognizable to me. I'm only 47. And in my lifetime, I don't recognize what I'm looking at now. Now, what I want to ask you is, what is the role of people like Bill Gates and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Gavi, funding the WHO, rubbing shoulders with our MPs? I mean, he is obsessed with vaccines. If it was really about health, there are so many other things we can do to optimize our health. Lifestyle choices, fasting, proper nutrition, proper whole food, exercise, minimizing stress, getting out in nature, that you could advocate for. And actually, what our governments did was the exact opposite. They told us to isolate, stay indoors, not have any treatment. What is going on here? Because is it just corruption and money and greed? Well, what do you think?
Well, I don't have time to go into this now. I don't think we or anybody else has the time to go into it. But the summary is, I personally think, and I know two people who wanted to introduce me to the Gates Foundation and perhaps to get funding for what I do. And I told both of them, I said, in my view of my research things, I said, all the applications I've made to the Gates Foundation have been turned down. I thought perhaps they weren't as good as others. I now know that what was funded, even I could say, would never ever get anywhere or be pointless. I've come to another conclusion. I think Bill Gates has done more damage to the world's health than probably any other individual, aided and abetted by Tony Fauci. I mean, it's unbelievable the damage this drive for vaccines has done, particularly in the third world and Africa, where it is obvious. And we go right back to our own, is it Jon Snow, with all our cholera and stuff like that, that, you know, correcting the water, food, nutrition, vitamin D would do actually far more for the overall health of populations than some untried vaccine that you jab into everybody, and if there's any problems, you move on to the next one. I mean, I used to think that was I thought all this vaccine against everything was good. No, this has actually made me start to look back at everything else. And I think some vaccines have done unbelievable harm that I was under the perception from my books and textbooks and general reading that they had actually were very, very good. I mean, go back with regards to vaccines that have been absolutely globally very, very useful. I mean, you go to smallpox and polio, even that serves regards to the continuation aspect of it is. But after that, an awful lot of vaccines were just rolled out because they could be. They were vaccine institutes like, you know, the Merck, the big Merck issue. But, you know, Maurice Hillman, who I knew very well from my HIV days, and they were trying to get an HIV vaccine, which I knew at the time it would fail, doomed. So I wasn't too bothered particularly by it. But he did stun me. I had dinner with him a couple of times, not one-to-one, but a few scientists at meetings. He stunned me. He said when he developed a vaccine, he said he never slept well till the 3 millionth person had received the vaccine without a significant side effect. It wouldn't have got beyond 100 people, the COVID vaccine, if he'd been in charge.
Yeah. Gus, can I ask you something? You talked about the sequence you and your colleague looked at. Now, apparently the sequence was published by China. Now, there's a lot of people who are in the awake movement who are questioning whether there was even a COVID virus, SARS-CoV-2. They say nothing has been isolated. No one has physically isolated the virus. It says your computer stopped recording. Do you know why that might be the case? Gus Dalglish's computer. It's hard. It's a hardware limitation. It's on your computer. I think what I'll do is I'll leave it here because it's not going to record anything further on your end. But listen, Gus. I think what's happened, Gus, is that the data capacity on your computer's filled up, so it won't save anything. So actually, they won't be able to hear you from now. I just want to say to you, Gus, thank you so much for coming back and willing to agree to talk to me. I really appreciate that. What we need is dialogue. What we need is to hear. And to summarize, it sounds like you were bullied. You tell me you're bullied. You had an article that was written and effectively your name was stamped on it, which I think is incredible. You tried to write back and counter and talk about your concerns and they were not interested and they didn't want to publish anything from you. And now you're being ostracized and, you know, your colleagues are, you know, not agreeing with you at all, even though you're raising alarm bells. You're trying your best to raise awareness and writing articles. And I thank you for that. And I'm grateful that you've admitted that you were in some respect duped, but we were under a lot of psychological warfare, frankly. And I think it's okay to acknowledge that that happened because we're only human, but it's also important to be able to put your hands up and say, this is not right. You know, I was manipulated by fear, by propaganda or whatever it was. So I just want to say thank you very much. Hopefully one day we can talk again. In the meantime, keep up your good work and a good fight. Thank you so much.